Rewiring Your Life with Erica Spiegelman and Marcia Stone. Wellness, inspiration, support.
Welcome to Rewiring Your Life. My name is Erica Spiegelman, and my co-host Marcia Stone will not be with us today, but she gets to listen to this amazing podcast we're going to have. We have an incredible guest who's changing the face of the recovery world and doing so much. Our guest today is Evan Haynes. He's the co-founder of Oro House and specializes in admissions marketing and business development. He's an active participant in the recovery world and felt naturally for Evan to transition into the sober living business where he's helping others maintain their sobriety. In 2010, he and Jared Valentine founded the Roots of Oro House, which in less than 3 years became one of the most successful sober living residences in the Los Angeles area. Evan has the amazing ability to connect with his clients and bring out a sense of hope in all of them. Evan has a master's degree in community development and right now is getting his doctoral clinical psychology degree as we speak. So welcome, Evan, to the show.
Well, sure, of course. And actually, so that was 11 years ago. We started as a sober living. But since then, we actually have fully licensed, joint commission accredited, detoxification, inpatient, residential facilities. So we've actually come a long way, surprisingly, even to myself. And as a sober living, now outpatient, inpatient operator, I also felt limited being a non-clinician, being in the sort of marketing business end of the field. I felt a calling to enter into the clinical side of the business. So I'm actually, as well now, a doctoral candidate, earning my PhD in clinical psychology. So it's kind of all just, it's been this calling. It's been, I mean, I can go back in time. It's my destiny.
Yeah. Yeah. So for now, like that you are getting more into the clinical side, have you found that in terms, like since I'm in the recovery world myself and a counselor and I've written books about this, do you feel that there's a new like paradigm around different ways in which people can recover, you know, just than the traditional ways? Have you found that you guys are offering something different to your clients, or is it more traditional in terms of like the clinical piece?
It's one of those things where I think there's almost like a paradox where, you know, the more contemporary, the more on the kind of cutting edge we are, we're finding we're really kind of going back to some older roots. And I'm kind of a historian myself. I love thinking and talking about the history of really how we've treated mental health, which, you know, addiction falls under in the West. And it's been such a brutal, punitive, even violent institution for so long. Interestingly, briefly, in the 1800s, the Quakers founded something they called moral treatment. And you went onto these facilities and they were beautiful with beautiful gardens, and they were having tea parties and lunches, and you couldn't tell even apparently who was a resident, who was a patient, who worked there. They really broke down some of those hierarchies, and it was this beautiful, albeit fairly short-lived experiment. And if anything, we're in that vein. We're tapping in as well, I'd say, to that. Even though we're kind of a non-12-step facility, we're tapping into that original spirit, that kind of big bang moment between Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, who founded AA, where it was really just two people talking and connecting and relating with each other. So somewhere along the way, and I have theories about when it started, addiction treatment became this very brutal, condescending. I mean, it wasn't as violent, as overtly violent as mental health treatment had been prior, but in a really kind of subtle way. It was the communication turns violent. It may not have been physically violent, but there was something very punitive about it. And it still lives on. If you talk to someone like Maya Salvitz, it lives on in the adolescent treatment, the kind of behavioral modification type of treatment settings. It certainly lives on, I think, in the low-income county facilities, the sort of therapeutic model. So yeah, we're really trying to kind of break through, and we founded created something we call the compassionate care model.
I love that. That's beautiful. Sounds nice. I want to hear more about it. I think you're definitely onto probably many, many wonderful things. It's wonderful to hear too that there's an open-mindedness, open-heartedness to see what really does work, because it's not a one-size-fits-all. I feel like every client is different and there's a different path to recovery for everybody. But definitely, you know, in terms of language and planting seeds and kind of that emotional awareness right off the bat, it could be so different for somebody without kind of that language around there that is wrapped around negative self-talk or shaming or, you know, things like that, which in treatment has a stigma and had it. And I think it's totally changing these days. And it's wonderful that, you know, we have people like you kind of leading the way for that. So that's wonderful.
Yeah. And I think it's the illiteracy, you know, around that history, around the approach. I mean, we take that kind of more punitive, condescending approach for granted. We think, well, that's how you do treatment. You break them down and build them back up. So it's actually the illiteracy and the lack of awareness in the treatment providers that's, I think, potentially causing so much of the harm. And, you know, so our model is really based on, again, it's kind of everything, you know, old is new again, you know, based on Carl Rogers in the 60s and 70s formulated something he called person-centered therapy, which is really based on this idea of unconditional positive regard, which itself was based on the assumption that people have within them an innate healing ability, and given the right conditions and the right circumstances, which for him was this really love and openness and spaciousness for them to really tap into this, their own power to transform their lives and heal. And so it's a remarkable thing. We see it happen over and over again.
Yeah, for sure. I know. Well, I've been sober 15 years myself, and I wrote a book called Rewired, and I have a program around that kind of concept of, really the foundation is self-love, like you were just talking about Carl Rogers, but it's like, how do you get to self-love? And I, you know, I think too is obviously changing the way we think, our thought habits, and, you know, making sure that we, you know, do things that we are proud of and repetitively, so that we can change those pathways in our brain, and, you know, taking action towards things that create positive self-regard, like that, you know, like getting up and exercising and sleeping well and having good boundaries and communicating properly and having healthy people in our lives. And there's so many layers to what we could teach people and how to kind of rewire themselves to, you know, once the drink or the drug's put down, now what, you know, and how do we really build from there? And yeah. And so I think that's wonderful that we can, you know, spread that message that it is possible. And it's just about getting the right tools and shifting, you know, all of our narratives that, you know, I think for so many of us in our early childhood picked up on narratives, heard narratives, you know, attuned to them through our society or our parents. And now we kind of have to take a look at our own narratives now, and which ones don't work, which ones do, what do we have to change, and what do we have to kind of figure out is causing us to want to escape, right?
Well, exactly. And to be able to identify, and they've been called various things, these unconscious belief systems or schemas. I'm a big fan of schema therapy. So, you know, we would ally with the client and help them identify these unconscious belief systems. And although they may never, you know, completely disappear, the more awareness of them that we have and see how they've been operating in our life, the better chance we have, I think, of replacing them, like you say, which sounds like a real cognitive behavioral approach, which is our approach to kind of a trauma-informed cognitive behavioral approach. But looking down into some of these internalized object relations and in some ways with that unconditional positive regard, because, you know, when you think about it, the only people in this world who kind of receive that kind of love, unconditional, truly unconditional love, are children. And with a lot of our clients, they grew up in such difficult households, or where there was a lack of attunement or attachment and things like that. So we're really stepping in often where their own development was arrested, and really I guess, kind of reparenting and stepping in as the in the role of that parent, and then really picking up where that process may have stopped, but showing them their strength, showing them their value. But yeah, I mean, many psychologists, Carl Jung, I would say, you know, would have thought too that and said that the psyche is self-creating, self-organizing, and self-healing, and it just again needs to be given the right conditions. And so for us, those conditions are community, that so many of our problems were created in these networks of relationships. Well, then for us, it seems only kind of obvious that the healing process as well needs to occur within a network of relationships, but the relationships are different. We want to show our clients how they can then go out into the world once they've left, say, our facility and create that really that support system. And as you say, I mean, I think addiction, I'm a sort of student of Mark Lewis. I don't know if you've read Biology of Desire, but like you, I mean, that we're rewiring our brain, that there's, thank God, neuroplasticity, that we're able to do that. But for Mark Lewis, you know, that addiction isn't even a disease. It's just a product of deep learning, and it's really just habituation. It's just habit, which can be it can be behaviors, it can be drug use, it can be ideas, even about how the world works or who we are. And it's fascinating.
Yeah,
I
love that. It's fascinating. I'm going to definitely order that book and read about what he has to say. Yeah, I think that there's so much around this. But yeah, I think that, you know, in general, I think people are looking to, like you were just talking about, I want to hear about Oro House, the Oro House Farms project that you guys are doing. But I just wanted, you know, in terms of like community and feeling like they belong and feeling like they find the right, you know, words to kind of identify with their new life, like all of this matters, you know, like you were just saying about this man, Mark, is that, you know, I think different words resonate differently. Like for me to say a disease didn't help me move forward. So again, I picked and kind of chose what I wanted to believe about myself. I didn't want to stand up every day and say I'm an alcoholic. It did not feel intuitively correct for me when I'm a healthy woman running, you know, 5 miles a day, and I've been sober for 5 years, and I, you know, I take care of myself, I have good boundaries. So to call myself something that had a negative connotation did not sit well with me particularly. It doesn't mean that those things don't work for other people or resonate with other people, and there's always, you know, I think a connection behind whatever we kind of are attracted to. But I do think that the community piece for sure is so important. So could you tell us a little bit?
Well, I will. I just want to add on to that Mark Lewis in that book, Biology of Desire, it points to some research that shows that the single greatest indicator or predictor of poor outcomes in treatment was the person's kind of adherence to the disease model of addiction. So the more that they believed they had a disease, the less likely they were going to have a successful outcome. It's really interesting. And at the same time, I think what's happened in the 12-step world is that they kind of lost their way. The origin, again, was just this really just this conversation, just a cool getting together and an inspiring of one another that occurred between, you know, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. And it's been lost. It's been turned into this kind of weird control thing. And it's almost like, yeah, the worse of an addict or an alcoholic you are, the kind of better you are. So you just kind of go in and you admit all these faults,
and
all these awful things yeah. about yourself, and yeah. the more things you can list, the kind of better yeah. you are. And it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense.
Evan, I want to just say something before we talk about the Oro House too. Just anyone even listening, you're sober yourself too, right?
Yeah, I am. Since 2005.
Congratulations. It's wonderful. So both of us talking, I just wanted to also clarify for people listening, two things are true. Even if I don't call it a disease or see it that way, I also know that I'm not going to go create that relationship again for myself, because I know I will fall back into those habits because of the physiological effects that alcohol has on me, that I know the way that I respond. as an individual, you know? So I just want to tell that, you know, to our audience too, that two things can be true, you know? Like I don't need to call myself an alcoholic every day, yet I know that if I go back to alcohol, my life will probably wind up down the drain again, you know? So again, it's like, I just... And I feel like we have that kind of kinship on that belief system. And it's just good for people to know that two things can be true, you know, that we don't have to always choose a side or choose a way. You know, it's like we can embrace and encompass so many different beliefs and, you know, make it work for who you are. You know, I think that's important.
Habits are as you know and write about and talk about, are so powerful. And the very nature of a habit is that they kind of become invisible. We don't put a lot of thought into them. They become pure impulse. I mean, it's very scary. Addiction is a real thing. It's killing, you know, now in the last 12 months, 100,000 people. Alcohol kills, and that's not even including people who have kind of lost sight of the fact that alcohol kills about 88,000 people every year, has for a long, long time.
Wow.
And let alone all the other deaths of despair. I take a more personally kind of a philosophical view. I'm somebody who's really interested in the culture of the West. And I feel like we're a culture that's lost its way. And as a country, the modern world itself even has fallen into its own habits, and things have become invisible because we take this world for granted, whereas we have the ability to feed, clothe, and house every single human being on Earth, we don't imagine that that's possible or desirable. So I think I happen to believe, and I just wrote a book with our other partner, Bob Forrest, called "Can America Recover? Reimagining the drug problem." Yeah, and we drew a parallel.
Oh, really, I'm dying to read that.
Oh, well, thank you. We drew a parallel between, you know, the sort of state, I guess, of America, but really of like industrial civilization itself, kind of reaching its rock bottom moment, and where there is this reckoning time. So I always like to think that it's people who have found recovery, who've managed to kind of wake up from this almost like robotic semi sleepwalking state where we just go through things so habitually in these routines and customs, and we start to question them, and we say, why are we doing this? Or I can't do this anymore. I can't. And so we're the leaders, the people in recovery, the addicted people, or the formerly addicted people are now the way showers for really like a whole, I mean, because frankly, it's the normal people who scare me, the people who don't see that there's problems. Yeah, addicts are like my people. Right. Those are my friends. These are the people brave enough to look at their own stuff.
So absolutely, most courageous. Word,
but so courageous. And so they're examples for the rest of us to sort of say like, God, it's not... I see clients who are dealing with old tax problems and, you know, I think they call it the wreckage of the past, but just like going through these difficult, difficult legal problems, money problems, family problems. And I mean, the level of courageousness is so inspiring to me, and I think would be to anyone who can kind of... So that's what the book is about. It's really like a love letter to addicted people and to the people who love them and want to learn more about them. Yeah, and it throws the whole history on its head, and hopefully helps people, you know, to stop kind of taking for granted so much. Let's start questioning things.
Oh, well, I can't wait to read it. We'd love to have you back on to talk about it more and promote it for sure, or just support you in any way, actually. Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, I'm from San Francisco. I grew up in the kind of the city, and then, you know, in the Bay Area a little bit down south. But when I go back to that city, it's just, I mean, even downtown in LA, it's just, I mean, it's the mental, the scale of the devastation that that you witnessed down there in the Tenderloin and all these areas, it's just, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And it's like, where do you start? You know, it's just, and I guess there is always a place to start. We could start in our own lives, doing what we're doing, but it is such a large scale of an issue.
Well, I think it's like learning the history too. And actually in the book, we go through a whole history of homelessness, and I learned so much, like
mental illness, drug addiction.
Well, it is, and what's so interesting is apparently the levels of mental illness, it's about 40% in the population of homeless people. It's very similar to the general public, actually, and I was shocked by that.
Really?
Because that's the sort of myth. And so really, if you want to look at the origins of homelessness, you have to look back to kind of the Middle Ages, and to the disruptions caused by empire building, mm-hmm. land clearances, war, famine, plagues, and then all amplified by industrialization and urbanization. There weren't this homeless population before, and then they had to start building the institutions to deal with it. Poor laws at first, they would chase the poor people out of the towns, the cities, which usually had walls around them. And then, interestingly, in around the 1500s, you had the poor laws, and you also had 19,000, they were called leprosaria throughout Europe, Christian Europe. And those leprosaria had been where the people with leprosy had lived. Well, leprosy disappeared in about the 1400s. So you had about a 150-year period where they sat empty. But then all of a sudden they realized, well, let's put all these displaced people. They weren't even called homeless. They were called the mad, or they were called vagrants. They were called different things. And so whereas, say, in Paris, for example, they had the archers of the poor were these kind of almost police force, and they would chase homeless people out. Well, fast forward a few years, now they had in France one of these leprosaria was called the General Hospital, Hôpital Général. And so these archers of the poor were now called the hospital archers. And they would instead go out into the woods and bring back these homeless people and lock them up. And something like 1% of the entire population of Paris was incarcerated overnight. That's the birth of the asylum. That's the beginning of how we've dealt with homelessness, how we've dealt with, you know, what was called madness then, or now mental illness. It's how that's where the sort of prison began. So all of these institutions, again, that we take for granted, had these origins. And so we're saying, let's really look at this. Homelessness is not a new problem. It's hundreds of years old. And I believe I'm someone who subscribes to kind of a depth psychology. And that's the shadow of the West. That's everything we kind of can't bear to look at about ourselves and reject about ourselves. It's the kind of awful ruthlessness and brutality that we treat our neighbors with. And so until we learn to deal with this population in kind of like a really honest, I mean, it's like recovery. It's like looking at ourselves in the mirror. Until we learn to see that these homeless people are us, we're never going to get anywhere.
Yeah, amazing. So it's called Can America Recover?
Yeah, reimagining the drug problem. And so, yeah, it's not, you know, the problem wasn't drugs. It's like everything we thought it wasn't. And that was the process I went through writing it. And I'm, you know, I just hope anyone who reads it kind of goes through just a similar, very eye-opening. I just learned so much, and I became so enthusiastic about it. So if I can,
I love learning about this.
Yeah, if we can share any of that feeling with others, we'll have done our job.
Yeah, yeah, amazing, amazing. Yeah, I'm right now. I'm in the process of a lot of treatment centers are using my Rewired, an online educational program I created for centers and clinicians to use and clients to use outpatient, and if they have access to tablets. But I'm partnering with a company, which I could always tell you off air more about, but they're bringing in education for inmates and people incarcerated. So I'm going to upload my program and give it to them for free so that they can use it. There's, you know, not a lot for those people that are Incarcerated, yeah. So can you tell us just quick before, you know, we run out of time, just a little bit about the Oro House Farms project and anything else that's going on? Yeah.
Yeah, it was always our dream, and it's, you know, it's never quite, you know, taken off in the ways I would have hoped, but it's a dream that I'll never give up on. But that anytime we can kind of incorporate social enterprise or some kind of business or something that's more sustainable, like the old model where you just kind of enter this bubble for 30 days or whatever, and then you're supposedly fixed, but of course you're not, because habits take a long time to build and to maintain. And if the work we're doing in treatment and in recovery isn't really integrated into every kind of department of our lives, and obviously making a living is a huge, huge, you know, it takes up the vast majority of time in our lives. And so,
and your worth is, well, so wrapped up in it.
Your worth and your identity.
Yeah.
And so if people can't feel good about what they're doing and feel that sense of self-esteem and really that sense of community, like where we get to spend time, you know, every day with people we love, of course, it doesn't belong. It doesn't mean there's not drama and conflicts, but, you know, we get to work those out together. And so it's always been a dream, whether it's a restaurant, a coffee shop, a farm. It's been done around the world. It's been done to varying degrees of success. And it is I think it's an emerging treatment model. And it's got a whole history too. We have a whole chapter on it in the book, but so it's something we just want to keep working toward. We're not quite there yet. We've had a few projects over the years, but I will never give up on that one.
That's great. No, I loved it. Because I read briefly about it, so I just wanted to kind of ask you about it, because I think it's...
Yeah, it was a real thing. So what happened was in 2018, we had the Woolsey Fire, and 5 of our 6 facilities burned down in Malibu. So we've been just kind of like in a recovery mode, I guess you could say, since that was November 8th, 2018. I'll never forget. But everyone was okay,
gosh.
Thank God.
Yeah, thank
and
God, thank God.
That's all that matters.
I know. I remember well. Well, thank you so much for coming on today and sharing everything with us. And I would love to support the book and hear more about it. And, you know, it's another exciting journey for you as an individual in general, just writing a book and getting it out there. It's wonderful. It was, yeah.
Well, thanks,
it's a great
Erica.
Gift that you're giving everybody. Yeah, and can you tell everybody where they could find you or find Oro House, and if people are looking for, you know, somewhere for their loved ones or curious about, you know, what you're doing in the recovery world? Yeah.
Well, I would definitely recommend going visiting our website, ororecovery.com. And our admissions people are always happy, even just to talk to someone. We can help somebody through an assessment and just sort of see if our place is the right place or what level of care they might need. And so we're just always here and always happy to take those calls. But our whole philosophy and our mission, I think is pretty well described on our website, and there should be links to our social media there as well. But yeah, we call it the compassionate care model, and our motto is connection, not control. And, you know, of course, that's the idea that the therapeutic bond, aside from any other particular modality, is the number one contributor to positive outcomes. And again, like I said, we've demonstrated that over and over again. And people can just tell that they walk onto the facility and they can tell there's a whole different spirit.
Vibe,
to it,
huh?
We're not here to change anyone or fix anyone. And in fact, there might not even be anything wrong with you. There's just some habits, and we're here to teach you some new habits and to give you a positive experience of what recovery can be. It's not always easy, but it can be a really, really, really good life, and it's worth it.
Yeah, and the journey, you know, the journey just from a personal standpoint of just getting there in the middle of it was the most beautiful looking back. So for anyone that's, you know, always, if someone wants to jump ahead a year, I know that feeling, but it's such a beautiful time to learn who you are and again, have that, I think, contrast, you know, finally of like seeing what you can have and what you did have. And it's just, yeah, it's a very special time, and it's not easy, but it's special. Yeah, yeah.
And it never ends. Yeah. It's a constant unfolding. It's a magical thing.
It is a constant unfolding. I'm 15, going on 15 years, and it's like, you know, and it's different stages, having kids now and having this and, you know, different life stages that you go through. And it certainly follows, you know, it's always a priority. My health comes first. My self-care comes first. And that's great for everyone else. And that's what everyone should remember, okay. You know, take care of yourself first. Yeah. Evan, really quick, we wanted one last question. It's our deep dive question. And that is, Evan, what is your superpower?
Ooh.
We had to give it one word.
One word.
It could be maybe two if you need it.
Intuition. I've recently discovered I'm quite intuitive, and I'm learning to listen to my gut and listen to my intuition.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah, you are. I could tell you're intuitive. Yeah. Well, you're a wonderful human being, and I'm really honored that you shared your time with me today and with us on our show. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And until next time, be well.